Welcome everyone to our February day-long intensive here at Tahoma Zen Monastery. We had a winter storm come in overnight and there's inches of snow, some quantity of inches. Traditionally this would be the February retreats here at Tahoma because of course, COVID times. We're not holding the traditional week-long retreat. But of the four or so February retreats I've been to here, it snowed at three of them. So February snow here in Washington, not so uncommon, but winter tends to quickly fade away after February. Today, I'm going to examine a topic that's a little tangential to the course we've been reading through on Tori Zinji's Record of the Transmission of the Lamp text that we've been studying since last summer. 2 weeks or so ago, 3 weeks ago, I was asked to give a talk at the Zen and Tea that Watermoon Dojo puts on, our Seattle sitting group. And on that, I talked about way-seeking mind, using the example of examples from my own life, my own experience. And in the course of that, I mentioned that one of the questions that always comes up among practitioners, especially those who've practiced for a while, is the question of, why does the practice seem to work for some and not for others? And by work, I mean people have breakthroughs and some people don't in the same amount of time. Now, we always hold that, of course, everyone can have and will have a breakthrough if they apply themselves to the practice. But when somebody's been practicing for many years, and then somebody new comes and they just have this immediate breakthrough, that can be disheartening to some people. We compare ourselves a lot to other people. The ego gets involved, is involved in all of this for quite some time in the practice. And even though this is part of the reason why there's aspects of one's own practice that isn't part of frivolous conversation, you tend to not, if you're engaged in koan study, for instance, you don't tend to talk about where you're at and what you're doing on that, because people will compare themselves and be like, well, I've been practicing for 5 years and I'm only, at this point, and they're already racing ahead. Or you look at them and be like, they've been practicing for 2 years and they're only there. We're constantly comparing ourselves to others. And this ultimately is reinforcing the self, the comparisons, that discrimination comes from the self and is part of how the self hangs on. The course of the practices, we're constantly eroding conditioning and support structures for the self, and the self tries to cling to its existence, cling to its being the boss of your experiences. And so there's this whole kind of toolkit the self has, and among that is comparing ourselves to others, and we can have resentment or we can have self-aggrandizement depending on the individual case. Right, these are the three poisons, right? From ignorance of our original nature flows greed, holding on to what we like, attaching to what we like, discriminating in that way, and anger, which is reflected in pushing away, rejecting that which we don't like. And so this is the whole root of our attachments comes from these three poisons. We've been reading through the lineage in the Tori Zinji text. He begins going through the lineage, beginning with the Buddha, and where we're at now in the lineage is about halfway through the Japanese masters in our lineage. And you get this just endless succession of these men who have all had to break through, not only break through, but then go through deepening practice and advanced practice and maturing periods. And then most of them were the premier students of their teachers. So they, became their, would take over their temples or be sent to important new monasteries that were built. So these were all, inspirational and towering figures. And it's really, as I've mentioned before, that lineage is really this, as a sequence of debts that we owe. Whoever teacher you're working with, they had a teacher that had, as part of the lineage, and they had a teacher, and it goes all the way back to the Buddha, right? And each of these people have gone through and had usually multiple awakenings, have done all the work, had really reinforced this idea, and especially in the Rinzai lineage, which has, to this day, really maintained that seeing into original nature is what Buddhism is all about, and it's tied into this process of Inca, of transmission. There definitely has been cases, of course, where that is not, it's been not fully fledged and not fully matured, or even not much of a breakthroughs at all. There certainly is plenty of cases of that, but the stories that we have, and then the more recent history, is always oriented around this breakthrough. And so we just hear this all the time in Rinzai Zen. And your teacher that you might meet with in Dokusan or Sanzen constantly exhorts you, you must see into your original nature. I often hear this phrase, they say, just once you need to have this insight. See this once, and then you'll have it all. You only need to see it once. Well, sort of. We'll get into that later, but the practice is to see past those little self, that grasping ego, and into our original nature and confront reality as it is. That's what we're doing. So it's important, though, to remember that all the practices that we do, all the methods that we do, the Zazen, the koans, the silent illumination, or shikantaza, or hato, or awareness practices, or self-inquiry, any of these practices are just upaya, skillful means to help us see into our original nature. But they are not original nature themselves. None of them are the royal road. There's many, many upaya because there's many, many different minds, and they try to get the key that fits the closest to those locks, right? Each mind is completely individual, so they're already beginning with a kind of key that doesn't exactly fit. And we actually shape our minds to the upaya as well as adapting to us. But it's really important to not be attached to these practices and to not mistake the practices for awakening. Dahui says, in investigating the ultimate principle, take awakening as the standard. And so that is the Rinzai line. Take awakening as the standard. None of the other aspects that you see. We spend a lot of time talking about samadhi practice. Samadhi has nothing to do with awakening. It's a state of mind, and awakening is not a state of mind. It is simply being enlightenment with, simply being in alignment with things as they are. And nothing changes in the world, and nothing changes except for temporary structures in our brain. That can change, but that doesn't change any aspect of fundamental reality. And it's only this awakening that is, as Dawei says, the standard. All the rest of this stuff can be nice, can be useful, is a tool, helpful to us. Dawei notes that after his awakenings, and when he was an abbot of the largest monastery in China, that he said he would do stillness sitting, which is how he referred to Zazen, stillness sitting, when it struck him to do that. He said sometimes he'd wake up in the middle of the night and he'd go do it, and then he'd say afterwards, he said, I'd sit stillness sitting for half an hour, and he says afterwards, like, ah, the mind of the Buddha. Right? And sitting in that stillness and that silence, you know, in a deep samadhi, it's for the awakened mind, there's not a tiny little bit of self still present, and it's just refreshing, as he put it. But this continuous exhortation towards awakening that we have from our teachers, from the lineage, from the ancient masters, that can itself become a barrier. Awakening can itself become entangled with our egos, and it becomes reified, made into an object, a thing that we must attain, and an object that we seek after and grasp and then try to hold on to. And as I noted, the self engages in many different activities to try to hold on to itself. And in the course of our practice, you know, this one way identifies ourselves as a practitioner. I am a Buddhist, right? That's the self. The self identifying as this, I am this Buddhist, I'm a Zen, you know, whatever. I am a lay person or a monk or a priest. We make these identities. And that's all the self identifying with our practice. And since we spend so much of our time in this milieu and you hear from other people, and of course, you know, the ego likes the idea of being this awakened self, right? The ego's concept of awakening still involves the ego, still involves the self. And it is just like the self plus, right? The self plus awakening, you know, with greater wisdom or greater abilities or greater facility or able to respond more gracefully or just all these things that we kind of have these ideas, these notions of what the awakened self would be like, what the self thinks that. And you hear somebody else maybe casually mention, like, well, I had this one insight where blah, blah, blah. And, you know, once again, that brings up the resentments and the self-grasping. And, you know, over the years of that, you run into people who then turn that around, right? And kind of rejects this. They say, like, oh, you know, awakening isn't all that, right? Or, you know, it's mostly just talk. You know, I mean, these people really, you know, they didn't become magicians. You know, they're not gods. They're just people who know what they're, you know, have practiced a lot, right? You know, one can become like sullen and resentful and bitter even on this. And, you know, in this case, you know, we become our own worst enemy in that. And people continue on this sort of rationalizations in that vein and just be like, well, you know, I'm just here for my own well-being, or I'm just here for others, or I'm just doing this, you know, that deep samadhi, I come out all refreshed. You know, sitting in emptiness is true meditation. That's what it's really all about. This other stuff is these other people just talking. And, you know, you can find people throughout the histories to support a lot of those things. So when we hear things like we read through the lineage and those stories of those great people, or we hear stories from people we know, this is what they're doing, this Zen and Tea, is kind of people sort of coming to the path talks, and hearing those can be completely inspiring. You're like, oh yeah, I had some of these same issues and concerns of this person. Or, you know, like, oh, you know, once again, this person practiced for 2 years, had this breakthrough and continued on with, you know, and you just feel bad about yourself. So it really comes down to the fact that we always ourselves, as we go through this course of this practice, as we wear down the self, it always finds some way to reinforce itself, whether it reifies awakening as an object that it wants to have and hold on to, or if it poo-poos it, it's just, you know, not all that, it's something that isn't there, or you become resentful of other people, or it's all these things are of the self, that greed, ignorance, and hatred, these poisons the self, and it poisons all of the activities that we do. But the question always comes up, though, whether people voice it or not, but is the kind of thing that, you know, even in my fairly limited experience of taking questions and working with people and in the limited way that I do, the question about, you know, why isn't this practice working? You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. And the canonical answer, of course, would be that the causes and conditions are not ripe. You know, whatever it is, aren't ready. It's just that the condition hasn't arisen yet. So you keep with it and the conditions will arise. But of course, for any given individual, we can't really know what those causes and conditions are that would lead to awakening. You know, it's for all these questions, and this is, I made this point in my talk on the Zen and Tea, was it's just always the answer, the honest answer is no knowing. We don't know. We don't know who's answered this. But when one does look through the literature and you listen to these stories and you consider diverse things, not necessarily Zen or Buddhist, you can see some commonalities. Now, there's probably almost as many different ways that people have awakened as there are people, but they can fall into some categories, and there's certainly one that would be non-categorizable, unique cases, but most of them fall into these categories. And I want to examine this awakening from that orientation of what has been the experience that people have had in general. And we're going to look at this through a variety of different experiences. And the first of these is through what I'm calling natural awakenings. Sometimes you see this as spontaneous awakenings. This is what they consider the Pratika Buddha in Buddhist history, was somebody that, there's one thing, I think it's in the Torah text where they refer to like somebody who's gone out and watched things change in nature and realize the impermanence of all things and kind of find their way in from that. The Pratika Buddha is considered, even in the original Buddhist sense, not fully awakened, you know, not to nirvana, as they would consider it in that early thing, because they haven't kind of grasped the whole thing. They just kind of have this one piece of it. But just like any of experience, you have an awakening experience, and then you have to do this continuous practice from that to deepen that, and you'll have these other insights. So, you know, the Pratika Buddha is one of the kind of insulting terms in Buddhism, but it's not a bad place to start, I think. And, you know, whether these people would fall into that category or not, it's hard to say. So, the first of these categories I feel that you can look at natural awakenings into is what I call is through absorption. And I've heard maybe half a dozen stories like this about people who fell ill, or in one case I heard a story of a guy who was in a car crash and fell into a coma. And during the course of their illness or this comas, they end up being forced to focus on a singular thing. Let me read this short excerpt from Mumon Roshi of our lineage. It says, Yamada Mumon Roshi became a pupil of Kawaguchi Ekai, but his intense and austere practice of Zen caused him to fall ill with tuberculosis. He lived for many years in isolation, waiting for the end, when, one sunny day in June, he saw a Nanten flower and had an awakening. Now, in his autobiography, there's a longer telling of this story. He became the pupil of this Kawaguchi Ekai, who was an Obaku teacher, and he wasn't really doing exactly standard Zen practices, but he was doing ascetic practices. But he got tuberculosis, and he was sick for 2 years. And at one point, he talks about how pretty much all he did was spending his time breathing. Just trying to breathe, right? I can imagine some people in this COVID era are having this, where they're in the hospital, just trying to breathe. And all your attention and all your focus is on breathing. And then Mumon said he got up one day, I think must be feeling better at that point, somewhat at least, and opened the door and looked outside. And that's when he saw this Nanten flower, but also he mentions in the autobiography, there's just this panoramic scene, and it was just like all of a sudden, it was just like a vivid painting, just an explosion of intense color and experience all beyond the self. In the story about I heard about the person who was in the car crash, they actually had brain damage, and they're the kind of portion of the brain that has our little conditioned self in it was disconnected from that, and he just had straight experience, but it was unbelievably minimal. And there was one point he talks about all he could experience was just like one part of his body. I think his toe, just a toe. and they just had awareness basically of that. And then it gradually expanded, like maybe you could hear voices or feel his whole body. And then at some point, the self kind of reattached and knew there, but he didn't, you know, but it was diminished. It didn't have that self-driving of it. He'd had this experience now where he'd been without the self and could just operate without it. There's aspects that the self does, functioning interface between our original nature and the world that is useful. We use it as a function, right? It's when we identify with the self, and then there's the conditioning aspects, and there's self-reinforcing of negative thoughts and things like that. And these are all the parts that are barriers between us and natural functioning. And so this person who had had that experience, you know, had gotten past all the conditioning from that and knew how to operate directly. And like I said, I've heard other stories in this vein. I won't go into any detail on any of the other ones, but this is one way where people who have been ill in various ways focus intensely on one thing, and then something, usually something happens, like a sound or seeing something or an event that they then snap into awakening. And then another way that I've heard from people who have awakened spontaneously is through intense questioning. So for some people, for some reasons, often maybe something that happened to them as a child, they become consumed with a question. This was actually something I talked about in my talk, the Way Seeking Mind talk, because this was an aspect for me when I lost the answers to the universe, the important questions of our being that religion gives you. I felt it was important to answer those questions for yourself. Questions like, well, what is reality? Who am I? Those are the important Genjo koans. And that is a real hallmark of way-seeking mind, is this desire to know reality for yourself. What is real? What is true? And the most famous case of this, once again, I've probably heard about half a dozen of these, but the most famous case is Flora Courtois, who in the 40s had these kind of, you know, kind of strange seeming childhood experiences, kind of the veil parting a bit. And let me read one of these. This is the second. She had lists in her book. She wrote a short book about this experience, and this is her second experience. She said, standing in the kitchen window one day, looking out at where a path wound under some maple trees, I suddenly saw the scene with a freshness and clarity that I'd never seen before. Simultaneously, as though for the first time, I fully realized I was not only on the earth, but of it, an intimate part and product of it. It was as if a door had briefly opened and I stood there transfixed. I remember thinking, distant places on the map, such as Tibet and North America, are extensions of right here, all interrelated. So this isn't too different from Mumon Roshi's experience of opening that door after his illness, where she saw this like that. And that sense of looking out into nature and all of a sudden not realizing you're separate from it at all is an experience I've had as well, and I know what she's getting at here. So this experience led her, so she went to college in the 40s, and during that time that she was in college, she became consumed with the question, what is real? And for months, literally months, at least 4 months, all she did, really, was ask herself that question, what is real? She mentions like just not really kind of just sort of floating through studies and such, but just consumed with this question. And then let me read what she said about her third, what she called her third experience. Standing in April, Easter vacation arrived, and I went home to Detroit to spend a week with my parents. There, about 3 days later, alone in my room, sitting quietly on the edge of my bed and gazing at a small desk, not thinking of anything at all, in a moment too short to measure, the universe changed on its axis and my search was over. The small, pale green desk at which I'd been so thoughtlessly gazing had totally and radically changed. It appeared now with a clarity, a depth of three-dimensionality, a freshness I had never imagined possible. At the same time, in a way that is utterly indescribable, all my questions and doubts were gone as effortlessly as chaff in the wind. I knew everything and all at once, yet not in the sense that I had ever known anything before. All things were the same in my little bedroom, yet totally changed. Still sitting in wonder on the edge of my narrow bed, one of the first things I realized was that the focus of my sight seemed to have changed. It had sharpened to an infinitely small point, which moved ceaselessly in paths totally free of the old accustomed ones, as if flowing from a new source. What on earth had happened? So released from all tension, so ecstatically light did I feel, I seemed to float down the hall to the bathroom to look at my face in the mottled mirror over the sink. The pupils of my eyes were dark, dilated, and brimming with mirth. With a wondrous relief, I began to laugh as I'd never laughed before, from the soles of my feet upward. Within a few days, I had returned to Ann Arbor, and there, over a period of many months, there took place a ripening, a deepening, an unfolding of this experience, which filled me with wonder and gratitude at every moment. The foundations had fallen from my world. I had plunged into a numinous openness which had obliterated all fixed distinctions, including that of within and without. A presence had absorbed the universe, including myself, and to this I surrendered in absolute confidence. Often, without any particular direction in mind, I found myself outside, running along the street in joyous abandon. Sometimes when alone, I simply danced as freely as I did as a child. The whole world seemed to have reversed itself, to have turned outside in. Activity flowed simply and effortlessly, and to my amazement, seemingly and without thought, instead of following my old sequence of learning, thinking, planning, then acting, action had taken precedence, and whatever was learned was surprisingly incidental. Yet nothing ever seemed to go out of bounds. There was no alternation between self-control and letting go, but a rather perfect rightness and spontaneity to all this flowing activity. That's about as good a description as the awakening experience as one will encounter. And, you know, aspects of this you do encounter over and over again, that kind of wondrous joy in every moment is certainly something that people encounter. And it's a common, attempt to explain what it's like. The interesting thing on her story is that this was in the 40s, and she had no context. You know, even the beats were barely into Buddhism at this point, or in fact, probably weren't. There was D.T. Suzuki in the U.S., or you know, maybe still in Japan at that point. He'd come to the U.S., went back to Japan, and I think he returned to the U.S. in the 50s. So there was no Buddhism about. Certainly, the transcendentalists had looked into Hinduism and Buddhism, and you could maybe dig around and find that, but she said she didn't encounter this at all and just kind of kept it to herself, but stayed in this modality for a long time. And then 22 years later, in the 60s, she met Yasutani Roshi, and I think there's a whole story about that, about somebody who she had shared experience said, like, hey, there's this guy I ran into, you should talk to him. And so she talked to him, and he confirmed this as an awakening. And I heard from Mitra Roshi, she talked about Flora in a talk that I saw two Rahatsus ago. And she mentioned that Yasutani had offered to let her teach, you know, as a sanctioned teacher from her experience, because she had really lived this experience after that. And that was really unique. Sometimes there's some really kind of festers or just goes dormant or just lies fallow. These experiences that people have spontaneously. Or in her case, it wasn't really so much as spontaneous. I mean, she really put in the work doing that questioning as without ceasing for months. But in the spontaneous awakening category, there's the story of Barbara Ehrenreich, the kind of famous author, most famous for Nickel and Dimed to Death, that book about her time living among minimum wage workers. But she's written many, many kind of slice of life type books. And one of them was called Living with a Wild God, which was her experience that she had of what she called, referred to as these spontaneous awakenings. And in her case, she didn't know what to do with it. She was raised very atheistic and was like proudly atheistic and very scientifically inclined to study chemistry and such. And so she didn't really know what to do with them. And it did, they just kind of lingered on her as this something that she had to deal with. And, you know, eventually she goes back and studies different, you know, ecstatic experiences and religious traditions and the like, and then wrote this book, which goes into great depth about it. I've not read the book, but I've read this this online article that was written around when the book, she did numerous interviews and such around when the book came out. So here's just a, two quotes from that article from the book where she discusses her spontaneous awakenings. One of these reverberating experiences occurred in her early teens at a horse show in Massachusetts. Something peeled off the visible world, Miss Ehrenreich recalls, taking with it all meaning, inference, association, labels, and words. I was looking at a tree, and if anyone had asked, that's what I would have said I was doing. But the word tree was gone, along with all the notions of tree-ness that accumulated in the last dozen or so years since I had acquired language. So she was looking at this tree directly, seeing this tree as it is, not through the filter of language. And then her other experiences, she says, another occurred a few years later during a pre-dawn walk in Lone Pine, California, when the world flamed into life, she writes. There were no visions, no prophetic voices, or visits by totemic animals, just this blazing everywhere. Something poured into me, and I poured out into it. She admits she was hungry and sleep-deprived at the time. So in this case, just everything seems alive, like vibrantly alive. And this is, I think, not too far off from Flora Cortes talking about that wonder and gratitude and joy that she experienced every moment after her breakthrough. And you notice that in both of these women's cases, these things started when they were kind of young. The first experience, which I didn't relate from Flora, happened to her when she was younger. Like Barbara Ehrenreich is talking about when she was 12 or so, it sounds like. I mean, she says, the dozen or so years since I had acquired language. So assuming you acquire language at about 2, so she might have been 14 or 15, and then this later one when she was 16 or 17. And then in the course of the book, I think she talks about trying to reconcile this while she was at college a few years later. So this is an example of spontaneous awakening, and then an example as she relates, and I've heard her in an interview talk about this, where she just kind of kept this to herself and didn't think it fit into her kind of proud atheism and kind of lied fallow, but haunted her. But unlike Flora Cortes, she did not, I think, develop this, you know, in the, as I've said many, many times here, from the awakening, the Complete Awakening Sutra, which is so often cited by Zhangmi and as well as the whole Chan tradition and Zen as well as it absorbed Zhangmi, is that you have these all at once awakenings, right? Where you see everything as it is for a moment. And then there has to be this long, steady practice, a step-by-step practice. And in the course of that, you'll have multiple awakenings. Da Hui, who we're going to read a bunch from today, had 18 major kensho. And Hakuin said that he had 19 major kensho and numerous, he said, too many to count, minor kensho. And this is an incredibly common experience. And this is why the koan curriculum has developed as it is. In the traditional Rinzai koan curriculum, the mu is the breakthrough koan you work with, and you have a breakthrough, and it's often a kind of bypassing of all of our conditioning, right? It isn't all of it's gone, it's kind of shifted past to the self, past the self. And so it's kind of a shallow awakening. The self comes back pretty quickly, so you need to keep practicing. It's a huge mistake at that point to feel you're done. This is why we say we are never, you're never done. There's always more to see, but you're definitely not done from the initial breakthrough. Sometimes those initial breakthroughs can be deeper than others, but much more common in all the cases that that one gives you that. And you know, when I was involved in the koan study with my ordination teacher, you know, I of course began with mu, and you know, worked my way through mu, and then onto the other koans. And it is just how Dahui and Hakuin described in my experience as well. You know, you have to have that initial insight, shallow as it may be with Mu, and then over the course of that work, you'll have these other kind of, like Hakuin said, these kind of innumerable kind of little minor breakthroughs. And some of those are like these little insights into the self, right? You need to kind of, this is how you get through the conditioning. You have insights into the conditioning you have, into your attachments, and you can let them go. And then sometimes you have another insight into original nature, and those can be just these tiny little glimpses on the course of working on a koan, which helps you, you know, which is seen into the koan. And then sometimes, you know, and usually this is well outside of the koan work, it'll happen like Mumon looking out the porch window, or Flora looking out her window, where, you know, something triggers a deeper insight. And that's just the course of our practice, and this is why our practice continues on. But not engaging in that practice after we've had these insights that somebody like Barbara Ehrenreich had means that there's nothing to continue to erode our conditioning, and it just comes back. And then you can become, as I talked about at the very beginning, a awakened self, this idea that you're this awakened self that just can become a total egomaniac in that case. It's like I'm a self plus all this other stuff. Or it can just create these seeds of doubt like it did in Ehrenreich. Just where you just don't know what this meant, and it doesn't really do you any good. And then the last little one of these natural awakenings I'm going to talk about is through physical exertion. Sometimes through physical exertions, there's often, you know, a samadhi condition that comes through physical activity, the flow state, they call this in physical worlds. Something I experienced, bicycling, and other activities, but most dramatically for me in bicycling. But sometimes one can push oneself really hard enough to an actual breakthrough through physical exertion. And there's a great story from Henry David Thoreau where he talks about, in his book, The Maine Woods, he talks about trying to climb Mount Katahdin. And he tries this twice and he never succeeds to climb the mountain, fails because it becomes super cloudy the second attempt. First attempt, he started too late, and he ran out of light, and the second attempt was too there. But he talks about, over the course of this, how physically exertion it was. He talks at one point where he's like scrambling over branches, and he realizes that these branches are, you know, like 20 feet off the ground, and he's just in this thicket of branches on the woods. And then another point, he's scrambling over rocks, and it's just these horrible, horrible, you know, bouldering that he's having to do. And then he says, at length I entered within the skirts of the cloud, which seemed forever drifting over the summit, and yet would never quite be gone, but was generated out of that pure air as fast as it flowed away. And when a quarter of a mile further, I reached the summit of the ridge, so he's on a ridge towards the summit of the mountain peak, which those who have seen in clearer weather say is about 5 miles long and contains 1,000 acres of tableland. I was deep within the hostile ranks of clouds, and all objects were obscured by them. Now the wind would blow me out a yard of clear sunlight wherein I stood. Then a gray dawning light was all it could accomplish, the cloud line ever rising and falling with the wind's intensity. Sometimes it seemed as if the summit would be cleared in a few moments and smile in sunshine, but what was gained on one side was lost on another. It was like sitting in a chimney and waiting for the smoke to blow away. It was, in fact, a cloud factory. Anyway, he goes on, this is a long passage, and I have to kind of skim through it. There's this great part he says at the end of this section here, where he talks about, he says, the tops of mountains are among the unfinished parts of the globe, where there is a slight insult to the gods to climb and pry into their secrets and try their effect on our humanity. Only daring and insolent men perchance go there. Simple races as savages do not climb mountains. Their tops are sacred and mysterious tracks never visited by them. Pamola is always angry with those who climb to the summit of Katahdin. So that was just this example of how hard this was to climb. But then he has this another long passage, and I'll see if I can't skim to the crux of this. Because he's talking about, He says, perhaps I most fully realized that this was primeval, untamed, and forever untamable nature, or whatever wise men call it, while coming down this part of the mountain. So he has this thing where he's kind of gone up to the top, and then he has to abandon the ascent because of the clouds that he was in. So then he continues on. He says, we habitually presume this is it difficult to conceive of a region uninhabited by man. We habitually presume his presence and influence everywhere. And yet we have not seen pure nature unless we have seen her thus, vast and drear and inhuman. Though in the midst of cities, nature was here, something savage and awful, though beautiful. I looked with awe at the ground I trod upon to see what the powers had made there, the form and fashion and material of their work. This was that earth of which we have heard, made out of chaos and old night. Here was no man's garden, but the unhandseled globe. It was not lawn, not pasture, nor mead, nor woodland, nor lea, nor arable, nor wasteland. It was the fresh and natural surface of the planet Earth, as it was made forever and ever. To be the dwelling of man, we say, so nature made it, and man may use it if he can. Man was not to be associated with it. It was matter, vast, terrific, not his mother Earth that we have heard of. Not for him to tread on or be buried in. No, it was being too familiar even to let his bones lie there. The home, this of necessity and fate. There was clearly felt the presence of a force not bound to be kind to man. It was a place for heathenism and superstitious rites, to be inhabited by men nearer of kin to the rocks and to wild animals than we. We walked over it with a certain awe, stopping from time to time to pick the blueberries which grew there, and had a smart and spicy taste. Perchance where our wild pines stand and leaves lie on their forest floor, in Concord, there were once reapers and husbandmen planted grain. But here not even the surface had been scarred by man, but it was a specimen of what God saw fit to make this world. What is it to be admitted to a museum, to see a myriad of particular things, compared with being shown some star's surface, some hard matter in its home? I stand in awe of my body. This matter to which I am bound has become so strange to me. I fear not spirits, ghosts, of which I am one, that my body might, but I fear bodies. I tremble to meet them. What is this Titan that has possession of me? Talk of mysteries. Think of our life and nature. Daily to be shown matter, to come in contact with it, rocks, trees, wind on our cheeks, the solid earth, the actual world, the common sense. Contact, contact. Who are we? Where are we? So you can see that Thoreau came to grips with reality as it is, past his self. In this moment, and of course he puts it in very Thoreauian language here, which is wonderful. I personally am a great lover of Thoreau. But it's that physical exertion and that being completely lost in this unfamiliar cloud-filled world, in which there is none of the ordering that we humans have put on all of this. So what do these natural awakenings have to teach us? Primarily that what seems to be at the root of most of his experience is complete abandonment to one of these modalities. Stuck in one's failing body, intensely concentrating on each breath, on one's big toe, on living another minute, deeply wondering about the nature of reality to the point where it is the most important thing, the exclusive thing in one's life, pushing oneself beyond limits, driven by some ephemeral goal. All of these examples, and there are many more, they're all marked by this single-mindedness. Now consider that the various devices that I've talked about and everybody talks about in Chan and in Zen are sitting, the ascetic practices that we do. And remember, even though Buddhism is the middle way, the Buddha's term of the middle way was he ate one handful of rice a day. It's still pretty ascetic practice, and we still engage in that various deprivations. Samadhi practices, and then the various inquiry practices, koans, huato, self-inquiry. All these practices are ways to try to create the circumstances of these natural conditions that people put in. People had these experiences, and if you reduce them down, you're saying like, well, okay, so this person here saw, you know, just for whatever reason, a glimpse beyond the veil, and then was like, what is reality then? And was consumed with that. And then from there, it's not too hard to be like, okay, so what if you just ask yourself that question? You know, forget being driven to it. Here's a teacher telling you to do it. You know, she was consumed with what is reality. Your teacher might be making you be consumed with, does a dog have a Buddha nature or not? Right? And then we engage in these ascetic-ish practices. You can push yourself well beyond your endurance, beyond your limits, limits of sleep and physical abilities. You know, and especially if you have that single-mindedness, you can really, you know, really push yourself hard, right? Especially in the West, we give yourself some breaks on that. You know, we can, you know, not push ourselves as far, but, you know, when you're practicing at Sogenji, say, things like yaza are mandatory. In the Rinzai places I've trained here in the U.S., right, yaza is optional. And even, of course, at Sogenji, it wasn't all night. You know, it was 45 minutes or so, hour of the option of mandatory yaza. And then you can go to bed, but certainly you were, you couldn't give yourself that break, but it still, you know, comes down to what you're doing yourself. You know, and then all these other practices. So you can do breath practice, and it's, you know, how is that different from the person fighting for every breath, right? I mean, you don't have that relentless life and death question embodied in that same way, but we are all driven by that question of life and death. Though, this is the, I think what the real question gets to is, to what degree are we driven by that? Sometimes we can think about it, become very anxious, thinking like, what does it mean when I die? There's a point where Da Hui says, if you have not questioned where you, you know, what were you before you were born and what are you after you die, then, you know, it's like, if you haven't really questioned that yet and resolved it, get on with it, get on with the case. So Zen practice and Chan practice are formalizing and systematizing these kind of natural ways that humans probably throughout time have awoken through physical exertion, through questioning, through deeply concentrating on things. And those are the core practices of Zen. But with that, why is there still these barriers that we have? And I'm going to read a little bit from Da Hui. Da Hui wrote letters to lay people. He actually has a huge body of other monastic sayings as well, but his most famous works have been these letters he wrote to lay people, and he really encouraged lay people to practice, and it's a really, it's a good method, a good system he had for how lay people can practice that actually I really think should be taken to heart in the way Western Zen is done, which is mostly for lay practitioners. But let's read a little from him. He says, most members of the scholar official class, and all the officials in China, of course, had to go through this kind of a scholarship training. So you can think of these people, scholar officials, as basically the professional class, right? So people have like gone through college and are working in a professional capacity. But in their case, it would be for the government. All the professional jobs were bureaucratic. Most members of the scholar official class these days take mental reflection and calculation as their lair. When they hear in that way talk, such as this, they immediately say, doesn't that fall into emptiness? This is like jumping into the water to preempt the boat's capsizing. It's quite pathetic. Recently, I went to Yangshi and met Lu Jurin. Jurin has been interested in this matter for a very long time, but he also had a bad case of this illness, of fearing a fall into emptiness. There can be no mistaking that he is bright. I've asked him, you are fearful of falling into emptiness, but the subject who noticed this fear, is he empty or non-empty? Speak! He stood still, lost in thought, calculating what to reply. Instantly, I gave a shout. To this day, he's stumped and doesn't have a clue. This is because he takes the mind of seeking awakening and puts it right in front of him, creating his own obstacle. There's no other reason. You, sir, should make an attempt to do practice in this way, which he means his way, his method, after many, many days and months, spontaneously, it will click. So the essential thing here is, he's saying that these people's intellectualism, right, they're kind of calculating what to say, so they're not being spontaneous. They're like, what's the right answer to this question? Is one barrier. And then the other is, he said, this is because he takes the mind of seeking awakening and puts it right in front of him, creating his own obstacle. So this is what I was getting at in my introduction to this, is that we create these barriers, these attachments we have to awakening itself as this thing that we want, right? And this, as I noted, comes from the self. The self likes this idea of being awakened self, as long as it still includes the self, of course. So we create our own obstacles. We get in the way. Our conditioning and reality itself and all the distractions of the world is sufficient barriers, but we create more on this. Tongwei, in another letter, makes this point about another one of these barriers that we put in our own way. If you have your mind assume a posture of waiting for awakening, if you have your mind assume a posture of waiting for stopping to rest, which means you're awakened and have nothing left to do, even if you practice from right now until the future Buddha Maitreya appears, you won't be able to attain awakening. You won't be able to attain stopping to rest. You will just add on more and more delusive worrying. Preceptor Ping Chan said, the fact that the spirit light of prajna never goes dark is the wonderful way of 10,000 ages. In entering this gate, one does not preserve intellectual understanding. Also an ancient worthy, Ren Yong, said, this matter cannot be sought via having mind, cannot be gotten via no mind, cannot be reached via language, and cannot be comprehended via stillness or silence. This is top of the line, bogged down in mud and water, old grandma, skillful means. Often, those who practice Chan just memorize such talk. Little do they imagine that the reason for it is upaya. If it is a person who has grit, when he hears even a little bit of this sort of talk, he immediately takes the precious sword of the Vajra King and with a single blow severs the kudzu verbiage of these four roads. Then the road of samsara is cut off, the road of the common person noble one is cut off, calculation and mental reflection are cut off, and gain, loss, right and wrong are cut off. The person on duty right now is naked, neat, and tidy. There is nothing for him to grasp at. How could he not be elated? How could he not be unimpeded? And so this he begins by talking about what I call here passive practice. We are in the posture of waiting for awakening, waiting for these things to happen. So you just kind of continue sitting, and you're just like, I just do this long enough, awakening will occur, right? But the whole practice is always very active. Practice is active. Even like, Da Hui actually in his letters criticizes silent illumination practice a lot, and this was clearly a widespread practice with a lot of dead forms of it. But the great kind of purveyor of that, Hongzhi, was a great friend of Da Hui's. And he didn't criticize how he taught it. So there's ways where you can do it. And the way that Hongzhi talks about it is your mind is active all the time. You're sitting in silence, but you're not deadening your mind. And that's what these kind of, what Da Hui calls perverse teachers would do, is talk about deadening your mind. So you're active awareness all the time, even if you're sitting in there in silence. And Shikantaza is the Japanese rendering of silent illumination, right? It was often referred to as just sitting. Just sitting can be very dead sitting, right? But it's supposed to have this active element all the time, active awareness. And that's why they break it down in the silence and then the illumination part, right? And silence is the stillness. You're not adding thoughts, you're not adding things, but there's this awareness of all things, expansive, active awareness of all things, and it's not a deadening experience. Another thing that Da Hui talks about at length is this delusions of the intellect. He says here, habitual calculation and logical arrangement are delusion. Getting swept up in the flow of samsara is also delusion. Getting fearful and anxious about these things is also delusion. Today's practitioners, not noticing that these are illness, simply bob up and down in delusion. As it is said in the teachings, following after consciousness, not following after wisdom. By doing this, one darkens the original ground or original face. So these are the barriers that we put in. We think through things. There's a part in this, I couldn't find the exact quote, but there's parts where Dahui will say that when a smart person is listening to a teacher talk, they immediately jump to the conclusion. Like you start saying something, they jump to the end of the sentence. And so, you know, when you're doing that, you're not really hearing what people are saying, right? And even though these words can't get at this great matter, they're trying their best to be upaya, skillful means, to get you past these barriers that exist in the world there. They're to try to help you to help yourself, because only you can do this. And what is the root of this? I mean, he mentioned this in the previous quote I read, where he was talking about it comes from the greed, anger, and delusion, the three poisons, the grasping and rejecting at things is one of those. And then these barriers that we have of the intellect, of thinking that, but that's also conditioned reasoning, discriminatory reasoning. So he gives these, his main thing that Dahui looks at for this is a lack of commitment and confidence. I'll read a quote about this. He says, having no confidence in the existence of an entrance to awakening, they, the perverse teachers, consider awakening a deception. They consider awakening starting second at a game of chess. They consider awakening a upaya speech. They consider awakening a term to lure beings along. People like this cheat others and cheat themselves, mislead others and mislead themselves. You must be careful. So this also is what I was getting at in my introduction, where I talked about where people begin to poo-poo awakening, right? So this is where he said that's become codified, right? They're not seeing awakening themselves, therefore they're like, well, it's overblown, right? And in various periods in Chan's history, where they always ebb and flow, there's points where there was teachers who really downplayed awakening. This can be seen today. A friend of mine was reading through the official site of the Soto Shu, and there was and she was shocked to stumble across a quote that says, these days nobody knows what awakening is. So this is the stance of the official Soto organization. Another lack of confidence can be in oneself. The Buddhas and patriarchs have not a single teaching to give to people. All that is necessary is for the person on duty, it's our original nature, to have confidence on his own, give assent on his own, see on his own, awaken on his own. If you just latch into what other people, like the Buddhas and patriarchs, have to say, and don't bother to see on your own, I fear it will be taken that the Buddhas and patriarchs have deceived people. And so that's really the crux of Buddhism from the beginning to now is you have to see this for yourself. He says in another letter, the hilt of the sword lies only in the hand of the person on duty. You can't have someone else do it for you. You must do it yourself. If you stake your life on it, you'll be ready to set about doing it. If you're not yet capable of staking your life on it, just keep pressing hard at the point where the uncertainty is not yet smashed. Suddenly, you'll be ready to stake your life on one throw. Done. That's this about commitment, how much commitment that we need to have on that. But in the end, it really gets back to what I talked about in my other talk, my talk on way-seeking mind. And I didn't draw these conclusions since I was trying to work by example in that talk. And that talk is on the Water Moon Dojo website if people are tempted by that at all. You can watch the recording of it. So in the natural awakening examples, it really is the example of the intense questioning that shows us the ways. These other examples are these circumstances that can drive us into insight. But it is that need to know what is true and what is real and who am I. That is way-seeking mind. You come into the practice for any other reason that people come. People come to the practice for their own reasons, and they're all totally fine. Anything that brings you to the practice is great, right? It is a good thing. Encountering the Dharma is rare, as they say. And so you have to start in some way. So coming for your own well-being or, to improve your life, self-improvement, that's not what the practice is for, but it's not a terrible place to start. And so during the course of our practice, those self-oriented goals fall away, right? Especially if you've had any sort of just glimpse at original nature, then this way-seeking mind can be aroused. It says, most people have tastes of original nature. It's like a memory of a taste or the lingering scent of perfume in a room that somebody has long since left. You can, when you're in Zazen, you sink into a deep samadhi, and you're not experiencing original mind in a deep samadhi, but you're getting a sense of being past the self, and that can arouse the way-seeking mind. Or those like just tiny partings of the veils, like one could see outside and watching the changing of nature, or sitting in Zazen, there's those moments where suddenly everything just feels incredibly light and free and effortless. And those moments of samadhi doing physical activities, as you in that flow stage, and you just realize like this is what life is like to the when we operate from original nature. These can arouse a way-seeking mind, and we become much less interested in just self-improvement, becoming a better person, and however we're defining that, or the way they use mindfulness now to try to make you a better business person or more ruthless or just things completely disconnected from that. All those, whatever that is, whatever that brings you there, what's the greatest intentions, I want to be a more compassionate person, that can bring you to the practice. I want to alleviate my own suffering or the suffering of others even. And this can be self-oriented or noble in our way that our small world thinks of nobility. But these little glimpses and tastes and adjacencies, being adjacent to original mind, can awaken way-seeking mind. They call bodhicitta in Buddhism, right? The aspiration for awakening. And then that can let us orientate to the point where the practice becomes the most important thing in our life. When you're a householder, a lay person, your family and your livelihood and those things have to take precedence. But then there's points when you can allow the practice to be most important. Sesshin, of course, is the obvious example of that. You choose to come to Sesshin, and you can say, now, the practice this week is all that's most important for me. And there's always degrees of that, right? When you get a sesshin, you're doing that, you're putting away your livelihood and putting away the family for the moment to make the practice your most important thing, then one should also put away the cell phone, put away idle chatter and reading books or just all the other things that one could be doing in sesshin instead of just doing the practice. Because the way the practice works is you engage in some sort of intense introspection, intense questioning, and there's nothing else. That's all that's important for there, for that time being. And there's ways that Dahui outlines that you continue this practice in our regular lives. And this is something that actually should, I think, be more promoted and more shared with teachers. But, the teaching is that we all engage in is however there's teachers put it out there. But during the sesshin, we should be that single-mindedness. Because it is those two things, this absolute desire to know what reality is. And it has to be all-consuming. And we can kind of simulate that through doing a practice like koan work, the huato practice, where you just look at one question over and over again. And, they say, this comes from Dahui as well, that the essence of the practice is you have to have great faith that this practice works, that what it's talking about is real. You have to have this great determination, this bodhicitta, aspiration for awakening, and make it your most important thing. And then you have to have great doubt. And that's what Dahui is talking about when he talked about smashing through the uncertainties. It's this great existential doubt that you don't know what is real, that you don't know what happens after birth, and or before birth and after death, and that you must know. And all your other uncertainties, the small little uncertainties in life, can resolve themselves into the great uncertainty. And it is only that smashing through that will resolve all of these issues. And so, that is the whole essence of this practice. This practice has all been constructed for that moment of breaking through that uncertainty. And you can see from these people that have been driven by this question, what is it? What is this? And ultimately, that's the question we need to answer. We have to answer it for ourselves, and we'll only answer it if we're really driven to do it, even just for a period of time. You don't have to be driven to it forever. You know, 4 months of asking what is real, but that's all she was asking. And that's the kind of commitment you have to have. At some point, you know, we can do a lot of practice to prepare ourselves, and then at some point, give yourself completely to it.